WVUA-FM, Tuscaloosa.
Any opinions expressed in this program are those of the host and do not represent the thoughts or opinions of 90.7 WVUA or the University of Alabama.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Pulse of the Nation. This is Season 3, Episode 5. I'm your host, Braden Vick, here from WVUA-FM, and the primaries are over. The presidential primaries ended last Tuesday with Joe Biden winning the Georgia primaries for the Democrats, Donald Trump winning Washington Republicans. What an anticlimactic primary cycle. We're just going to get things right started with a primary cycle that, if you listen to merely the mainstream media, what they were telling you is like, oh, well, the Donald Trump might be favored, but he might actually have a competitive race. And, oh, Ron DeSantis, look at him and up in the polls immediately after the Republicans flopped in the midterms. And then Ron DeSantis, as I've mocked earlier, way earlier in the Pulse of the Nation series for longtime viewers of the podcast. My God, I have gone into Ron DeSantis. I have dug into him so many times recently. And that has not been more evident than the fact that the Florida primaries were this week. And Ron DeSantis only got around 4% statewide in the state of Florida, trailing far behind Nikki Haley, who is the other media darling. Oh, look, here is a moderate-sounding Republican who is whooping Joe Biden in the polls. Do you see that Wisconsin poll that came out about a month ago with Nikki Haley winning about 14 points or whatever it was on Joe Biden? Never mind the fact that Wisconsin tends to have wonky polls. See the ABC News, Washington Post, Biden by 16 poll they had in 2020. But let's disregard that, because Nikki Haley is beating Joe Biden. Not only that, cleaning his clock out in all these swing states. And the media is hyping this up. Oh, this could be competitive. You have Americans for Prosperity and Koch brothers all on this. And then Donald Trump just cleans up, wins over 70% in basically every state minus New Hampshire. And maybe Nikki Haley's home state is South Carolina. But even still, those are kind of lopsided victories, especially South Carolina. So the primaries are over. A primary cycle that has been over for about a year, ever since Joe Biden announced that he was, in fact, going to run for re-election, is now officially over. The delegates have been reached. We are now in the general election cycle, one of the longest, and not maybe the longest, general election in modern American politics. So, yes, here's a new election, same as the old election. And it's not just the candidates themselves. Obviously, Joe Biden and Donald Trump, both now unpopular, you know, unpopular executives. I mean, Joe Biden has, ever since the Afghanistan withdrawal, had pretty terrible approval ratings, and that has only seemed to get, you know, ever so worse with time. Usually when you have a president who's at like 38, 39% approvals in a lot of these polling averages, usually not a good sign for that president to go ahead and win re-election. It wouldn't be for Joe Biden if he was running against any other Republican candidate, except for Donald Trump. And I don't think I need to go into detail about his approval ratings. They're actually slightly better than Joe Biden's. I think that's more due to the fact that a lot of people maybe forgot that he was president. Like, I'm not even joking. Like, a lot of Americans, I think, have sort of pushed Donald Trump's presidency to the wayside. It was like, oh, push him out of your minds, you know, try to forget about him. But now he's back. And Republicans love him, as far as the Republican primary base goes, at the very least. I mean, they love him. And when Donald Trump announced that he was going to try to run to get the presidency back, in my mind, it wasn't any doubt that he would win very easily. Like, again, I bang on about these mainstream media narratives of half of the past few podcasts, but I think it does bear repeating that sometimes, well, a lot of times, to be honest, mainstream media, you know, their first job is to make a profit. And what makes profits? Horse races. So they made a horse race out of a primary that wasn't even really a primary. Like, it was essentially Donald, like, it wasn't really controlled opposition, but from the way the Republican primary base acts, it almost looks like controlled opposition. Nikki Haley, Ron DeSantis, and all these other bunch of rando nobodies. Yes, I am including Chris Christie in that. Thanks for asking. But now that that whole thing is now over, there are still a few like primary nominating contests, but those only matter for election geeks like myself. And I'll tell you if I see any trends from any of those primaries that don't match up with what we've seen in the rest of these primaries. With what we've seen in the rest of these primaries, though, it has been a sort of national trend. Where are these candidates doing the best? Where Joe Biden is doing the worst, Donald Trump seems to be doing the best. Where Donald Trump seems to be doing his weakest numbers, Joe Biden's putting up some of his strongest numbers. So let's actually go into the relative electoral strengths and weaknesses of both Joe Biden and Donald Trump as far as demographics are concerned. So we'll start off with Joe Biden. We'll start off with his weaknesses, of which there are quite a few. We'll start off with leftists, of course. You heard about all these, you know, pro-Palestine, uncommitted campaigns, and you saw that in, you know, a state like, you know, Michigan or a state like Hawaii, even though Hawaii only had like, what, 3,000 votes total in that caucus or something, like very low turnout, and uncommitted got a very high vote share in the state of Hawaii. Then, you know, you have a few of these other states, like Washington has an uncommitted campaign. Georgia has, I think, like a leave about blank campaign, or, you know, a few of these other states have, you know, have uncommitted campaigns that perform well-ish. Minnesota, it performed really well, especially in Minneapolis and St. Paul. So, I mean, you have that going for you. You have a bunch of, you know, younger, more progressive voters who were lukewarm on Biden to begin with, but, you know, a lot of them will have tolerated them because, you know, he is the challenger. He is not exactly a fresh face considering he was the oldest ever elected president, but, you know, compared to Donald Trump, it's like, okay, I'll vote for Joe Biden because, you know, anything to get Trump out of office. But then you see what's happening in Israel and Palestine. A lot of them are absolutely disgusted by America's support for the military actions of the state of Israel and the Israeli Defense Forces. So they go to these Democratic primaries, a lot of them do, and they vote uncommitted. It's a protest vote. And Biden's doing his weakest numbers amongst them. He's also doing his weakest numbers in that same vein amongst Muslim voters. Now, I will stress that while a lot of these Muslim voters are voting over the Palestine issue in regards to what the protest votes are, I will caution that there may be a hint of social conservatism in that, especially in Michigan. You go over to Dearborn, you go over to East Dearborn in particular, like you're going to see in 2024, you're going to see Joe Biden make massive losses, Trump make massive gains with East Dearborn voters. Now, the losses for Joe Biden, a lot of them will be attributed to Palestine, obviously. But the gains that Donald Trump is making isn't due to Palestine. For most of these, it's the social conservatism. If you remember in 2022, there was a lot of this, you know, drummed up culture war stuff regarding like flying pride flags, book bans, and all this stuff. And it hit Dearborn. And the Republicans in the state were trying to make alliances with socially conservative Muslim voters over the issue. It's like, hey, like we will reach out to you. We'll say the things you want to hear on a certain issue. And you could turn out to vote for us. Then now instead of winning East Dearborn 80-20, Democrats in Michigan were winning it like 65-35 or 60-40, you know. Even as Democrats winning Michigan by near double digits in 2022. So, like, I will stress that a lot of this, you know, Muslim protest vote, quite frankly, a lot of the losses Biden's going to be facing, you know, it's not just going to be due to Palestine. It's going to be due to social conservatism. Speaking of social conservatives, non-white social conservatives that Joe Biden has lost ground with and Donald Trump has gained ground with, Latino voters. That has been one of the major, you know, forms of, you know, Biden weakness, let's say, in regards to these primaries. And this is happening all across the nation. This isn't just a Texas thing or a Florida thing. It's popped up even in states like, you know, state like Ohio. You know, I was looking at Lorain County, Ohio a few days ago. You know, it's a county, it's west of Cleveland. It's a swing county. You know, Donald Trump, I think either won it narrowly in 2016 or Clinton won it narrowly in 2016. I think Clinton won it narrowly, then Trump won it in 2020. I'm not sure, but Lorain County was within a point in 2016, and then Donald Trump swung it to the right by 2 points in 2020. And that's owing to Donald Trump's gains in the city of Lorain, which is in sort of northern Lorain County along the lake coast, along the lake shore. And that city of Lorain has a high population of Latino voters. Latino voters shifted right all across the nation from, you know, Lawrence, Massachusetts, all the way down to Los Angeles, California. So not exactly too surprising there to see some of the protest votes going against Biden there in the Democratic primary. Those areas also where you saw Donald Trump's greatest strengths, or some of Donald Trump's greatest strengths in Ohio, in specificity, some of Bernie Moreno's greatest strengths, because in Ohio, they also had, you know, all these other primaries that were happening. And Bernie Moreno, the Trump-backed candidate, the car salesman, he won. And he didn't just win Ohio against the more moderate state senator, Matt Dolan, and, you know, a conservative secretary of state by the name of Frank LaRose. Bernie Moreno got a majority of the vote, over 50%, and he won every single county in Ohio. All 88 counties, Bernie Moreno swept. A huge win for, you know, the MAGA movement over the Republican old guard in the state of Ohio. But back to, you know, what this might mean for a general election, it means that, you know, an area like Lorain County, a swing county where a lot of the Democratic vote isn't just based off the white voters, it's based off of non-white voters, voters of color. And especially amongst Latino voters, Biden has been losing ground with them. And you absolutely see that in Lorain County. I'll come back to it later. I will caution, though, that some of these Latino protest voters are Republicans just voting for Democrats in the local primaries, because the local races are the ones for some of them that might matter the most. Nowhere is this more true than in South Texas, because you see all these terrible numbers for Joe Biden in South Texas, like in Zapata County, and, you know, and even an area like Webb, where Laredo is, even McAllen, some of the more rural counties north of McAllen, and Hidalgo County especially. A lot of these, you know, protest votes weren't exactly protest votes, you know, by Democrats against Joe Biden. These are Trump voters. A lot of them are Trump voters in 2020, especially in South Texas, where Donald Trump swung Tejano to the right by a gargantuan amount. And that was one of the big electoral surprises of 2020. Like, you didn't see a lot of votes in Republican primaries. Like you had Democratic primary vote share far outgain Joe Biden's vote share, vote margins in a lot of these South Texas counties. So, I mean, I do have to caution that. And also, you know, this situation is far more muted amongst Latinos in urban areas, say like a Corpus Christi or even a Houston or San Antonio, rather than in an area like, you know, Rio Grande City in Stark County, Texas. And I think some of these nuances do have to be studied, because the difference between a 5 to 10 point swing right and then like a 20 to 40 point swing right is absolutely massive and something that cannot be discounted. Like, those are the things that, you know, could end up winning and losing elections for certain candidates. And the more nuances we bring about, you know, urban versus rural, suburban versus exurban, the better. As far as the black voters go, because you see in the polling crosstabs all over, oh, Donald Trump's winning 20, 25%, 30% of the black vote in some of these polling crosstabs. And the mainstream media is making a bunch of stories about this. Oh, how Donald Trump is gaining massively with the black vote. You know, or how Joe Biden is losing young voters by 5 to 10 points or whatever. Like, I'm going to tell you right now, those polling crosstabs that you see, most of them just are flat out false. Like, it's not that the top lines are, you know, wrong or anything like that. It's that the crosstabs themselves, you know, there's too small sample sizes to, you know, be very reliable, because you often see a poll where, oh, Donald Trump's getting 30% of the black vote, and then another poll, Donald Trump's only getting 10% of the black vote, and you don't know which one is right. And you can't really make narratives out of that from one massive swing and from one poll to the next, and you know, all this sort of garbage that, you know, gets put out for clicks. The polls themselves aren't getting put out for clicks. The articles are, just to go ahead and make sure. But when I looked at these actual, the precinct data for a lot of these counties, I focused on Texas, you know, Florida and Ohio for this one. What I found was that for a black voter to swing rightwards, to swing more conservative, probably have to be a little bit on the younger side. I don't, you know, really remember the Civil Rights Act or the protests or the movement surrounding that. You don't have the same loyalty towards the Democratic Party that, you know, parents or grandparents might. And they also, a key here is, especially in an area like Harris County, proximity to Latino voters is key, because in around northern Houston, the northern Houston black population, Donald Trump did very well. But in South Houston, where there is more of a black population, but importantly less of a Latino population, the non-Trump candidates, particularly Nikki Haley, tended to do better than the statewide average in Texas. And that was something that really interested me when it first popped up. Now, Donald Trump overall, you know, the precincts where he did best in Harris County were a bit blacker on average than the precincts where non-Trump candidates did better than the statewide average. So I'm not discounting any black rightward swings. Like, I do think there will be a small swing to the right from black voters again. But the problem is, it's getting trumpeted up as this much larger, like, red tsunami when it's only going to be a red trickle. And it's sort of going to be pronounced in areas with already high Latino populations who are going to be driving a majority of that swing right. So it's something that, yes, Joe Biden should address, and he is addressing. He's tried to, you know, his campaign is trying to reach out to several non-white voter groups, reaching out to, you know, Latinos in Arizona, reaching out to black voters, and all these, you know, local or black focused magazines or, you know, podcasts or whatever, you know, and all that stuff, reaching out to Asian American, Pacific Islander voters, Native Hawaiian voters as well, you know, particularly in the critical swing states, which that got announced just a few days ago as well. So it's not like the Biden campaign doesn't know where the weaknesses are. But a key difference between Joe Biden and Donald Trump is going to be how much they're going to be able to spend, what are they going to be able to spend on. And I'll get to more of that as we go on. But we've covered Joe Biden's weaknesses, now let's cover his strengths. And what I found was that it's mostly more heavily college-educated areas. The areas with higher college education rates, which are swinging left, by the way, you know, swinging towards Biden, are the areas where Joe Biden's doing the strongest. And it makes sense. Like, you see this with Donald Trump, too. The areas that he's swung right, he's doing the best with, because, you know, those voters, they're swinging to that particular candidate. When both candidates are going to be on the ballot again in 2024, it's like, oh, this president was the first, you know, Republican I ever voted for, or the first Democrat that I ever voted for that particular position. It's like, okay, that person's running again. I can trust voting for them again. And so you do see that, you know, again, like in the I do go on about Harris County a lot, but you saw this in the Dallas-Fort Worth metro area, particularly, you know, the suburban counties of Collin and Denton, where, you know, it's the same areas, generally speaking, where Joe Biden is doing better than the statewide average. Nikki Haley or non-Trump candidates in general are doing better than their statewide averages as well. And it's the areas where you find protest votes in the Republican primary where Joe Biden's doing well. You know, that's evidence that those areas are going to keep swinging left. And the same thing if you do it vice versa, areas where Biden's doing weakest or areas where Trump's doing strongest more generally, those areas tended to have more rightward swings. And thus you can expect that those swings are going to continue. And the college educated thing, it cuts across demographic lines. Like, if you're trying to parse out Asian American, Pacific Islander votes and whatnot, it is usually, you know, more college education around ALIF and some of those Asian American communities. Donald Trump tended to do a lot better than a statewide average. You know, granted, those areas swung heavily to the right from 2016 to 2020. But, you know, especially in like an area like Collin County, you know, in Denton, you have areas with higher Asian American Pacific Islander populations, and these are going to be more so in, you know, South Asian Indian rather than Chinese or Vietnamese, and especially Vietnamese down in Alif. You know, those areas in, you know, Collin, Denton, even Tarrant counties, you know, they're more likely to see, you know, more protest votes against Donald Trump and less against Joe Biden, you know, than the average precinct in the state of Texas. So that is something that is an interesting story. So when I say meet the 2024 election, same as the 2020 election, I'm not just talking about the two candidates. I'm talking about the trends because they largely seem unchanged from 2020. It's something that, you know, neither party has really been able to stop. You know, the only thing that the parties think are able to do successfully is try to accelerate the favorable trends towards them. And they're both Joe Biden and Donald Trump are going to try to do that. But here's the thing in regarding these strengths and weaknesses. Yes, where Joe Biden tends to do strongest is where Donald Trump tends to do his weakest, so on and so forth, except for areas with high populations of leftist, you know, more progressive voters. That seems to be an exception in regards to the actual pro-Palestine dissent against Joe Biden. But when I talk about spending money to try and maybe rectify some, you know, voter-based turnout concerns or, you know, base voters potentially swinging right or swinging left, you know, against the candidate or whatnot, one thing that I think is going kind of under the radar by a vast majority of the American public is one simple fact. And I'm not saying this as a Democrat who wants Trump to lose or anything like that. I'm not speaking from any bias. I'm just speaking with cold, hard data. Donald Trump is broke. He is absolutely broke. And I'll tell you why. It's not just because of the legal fees, although that is a massive, massive, massive reason as to why Donald Trump has over $450 million in legal fees he's got to pay the judge, you know, off of those E. Jean Carroll settlements, you know, for defamation. And Donald Trump's having some liquidity issues. You know, his lawyers have sent that statement to Judge Engoron, or whoever his name is up in New York. Basically, they don't have the liquidity to post the bond necessary, you know, for that settlement, i.e., he broke. In rich man's terms, he broke. And New York Attorney General Letitia James, you know, just a couple of days ago, actually, you know, put in the first steps towards potentially seizing some of his assets. That's something that's been a popular discussion in mainstream media, especially on MSNBC. It seems like anything they discuss these days has to relate to Trump's legal problems or whatnot. Like, that's all Rachel Maddow ever seems to talk about anyways. But this is going to become a very real problem for Donald Trump's campaign. Because if you're going up to these courthouses to defend yourself against, you know, crimes that you're accused of, you know, whether it's a documents case in Florida or wherever that, you know, election interference case in Georgia goes ahead now that, you know, Wade's been kicked off the prosecutor's team. I mean, that is an entire story with Fannie Willis and Mr. Wade and whatnot that I'm going to leave towards potentially another day, maybe when that, you know, trial, when a trial date potentially gets announced for that, now that those proceedings can finally go ahead. And whether it's some of these other cases, what Jack Smith is trying to bring up, especially in D.C., you know, those are going to take a toll. They've already have taken a toll because one of the things to know about Donald Trump's fundraising efforts, a lot of that's not going towards his campaign for president. A lot of that's going towards just trying to pay off his legal fees to Lena Haba and all these other lawyers he's got, top dollar lawyers he's gotten to represent him. Now, I'm pretty sure he's being swindled and ripped off because the results these top dollar lawyers have been getting him not exactly the greatest, if you ask me. But I'm not a legal expert. mean, but he's got to pay them. He's got a nearly $460 million settlement he's got to pay in New York unless his golf courses in Westchester County start to be seized. Yeah, because they have discussed seizing some of them, you know, just north of New York City, Westchester County. You know, this is going to start to take a toll. And the money that Donald Trump is using from his donor base, small dollar donor base, and the big donors too, from the rich businessmen and these, you know, CEOs, these executives and whatnot, you know, they're going towards the legal fees. If they're going towards that, you can't pay money to do advertising. You can't pay money to do get out the vote efforts. And when you have news such as the, you know, because since he now has officially gotten enough delegates to win the Republican primary, the Trump campaign and the RNC have a, you know, Trump National Committee joint fundraising committee. They have a JFC now. But the problem is, whatever money that JFC raises, a lot of that's not going to go to the RNC. Like, a lot of that money, that JFC money, is going to go towards Trump's legal fees. And considering the Republican National Committee, as I have discussed before, is quite cash-strapped. Like, last year was its worst fundraising year in 2.5 decades, even when adjusted for inflation. And it doesn't look like it's going to be getting any better, especially considering that at the end of 2023, the Democratic National Committee had over 2.5 times more cash on hand than the Republican National Committee. And now you have the DCCC, the House Democrats, you know, campaign and finance arm, is now outraising the RNCC, which is the House Republicans, you know, campaign finance arm, by a good like $10 million cash on hand now. No, I think it was like $48 million to like $37 million. I believe that was the margin. And similar things with the Senate as well. But the big thing I want to focus on is just the presidential election between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. And I'm going to read out some figures. Just in cash on hand, because you've seen a lot of the headlines, oh, Joe Biden had mega outraised Donald Trump. But it's not just the fundraising part of it. It's not just the fact that the Save America PAC, which is one of Donald Trump's key PACs, spent more money on legal fees than it raised the money in a recent month. I believe it may have even been February. But you want to know the cash on hand for Donald Trump. I'll start off with Donald Trump. He's got $43 million cash on hand. Now, it seems like a lot of money, right? I mean, $43 million. You don't want to know what I do for $43 million. But when compared to Joe Biden, who's got $155 million cash on hand, that is nearly a 4 times jump. Nearly 4 times more than Donald Trump's cash on hand. That's appalling. That is nearly apocalyptic. And when you talk about the cash on hand, you've got to start building those reserves early. And the Democrats are doing this exceptionally well. That potentially is a consequence of college-educated voters and more wealthy voters potentially swinging to the left, because you're increasing that donor base of, you know, wealthy business people, executives, and whatnot, who are now voting not more based on their economic concerns, although economic concerns could have shifted left as well. But it's more for them due to, you know, they do not like Donald Trump. Or maybe it's because of, you know, social views they're more voting on now, or whatever it is. They're swinging to the left, and you're building more of a donor base off of that. And these swings are happening in areas which primarily finance Republican campaigns. Chief among them is going to get to the rest of Joe Biden's Sun Belt trip. He barnstormed the Sun Belt this week, but I want to get to a fundraiser, particularly in Dallas, particularly in Highland Park. Like, if you know anything about Dallas or Dallas-Fort Worth, you know that the Park Cities are very Republican, suburban areas of Dallas County. Those areas are very, very, very wealthy. And the Park Cities basically help finance Republican operations all across the country. So when you have a Democratic candidate for president, Joe Biden, coming in and these once super Republican areas and raising $2.5 million, that's got to not only hurt the pride of the Republicans a little bit, or not just hurt their egos, that's going to terrify them. Because an area which you had on lockdown, a super wealthy area which you had a lockdown on, you ain't got a lockdown on that anymore. Considering your finance problems, your fundraising problems, that's certainly not going to help you. Especially when the small dollar donors can't donate as much as they can for the Republican, you know, for the Republican Party, for Donald Trump. One of Donald Trump's greatest fundraising strengths was you have a devoted, almost cultish follower base who are going to donate a significant amount of their smaller incomes. They're going to donate a significant amount of that to your campaign because they believe, a lot of them believe, you have been ordained by God to help guide this country through hard times. So when, you know, that dries up, and it is starting to dry up, and it's not just that it's starting to dry up, it's these predatory, you know, campaign finance strategies that, you know, oh, you make a one-time contribution for like $20, all of a sudden it's $20 a month, and a lot of these people don't realize that. The banks are starting to catch on to this, and a lot of the banks, at least local banks, are like, oh, wait, hold on, this person didn't consent to this, so going to collaborate. We're going to try to cut that off. And so that is another factor into why Donald Trump's fundraising has been so poor. The major factor, I believe, is that the big dollar Republican donors, by and large, apart from a few, a lot of them don't want to fundraise for Donald Trump. You know, you don't want to be tied to a candidate with 91 federal criminal charges. Completely understandable. Especially if you don't think you're going to get a good return on investment. Especially if you think that candidate is going to do everything in his power to try to blow the election for your party. A candidate who you didn't want to be your party's nominee in the first place. Some of them are starting to fundraise for Joe Biden now. Some of those Haley voters. Some of those Haley donors. Like, there's six wealthy Haley donors, at least, according to that CNBC article recently. They're now starting to fundraise for Joe Biden. And outside of that, Mark Cuban. You know, Biden voter in 2020, sure. But he donated to Nikki Haley. And now that Nikki Haley's dropped out, now that you realize that Nikki Haley doesn't have a prayer at winning a Republican presidential primary in the year 2024, now he's like, I'll fundraise for Joe Biden. And he has done so. I believe he was invited to one of those recent, recent Houston event where he fundraised millions of dollars. Speaking of which, I'm going to give more details about that Sunbelt thing because there's another, you know, interesting development that's happening between the two campaigns is that Joe Biden has been targeted. I mean, he has been targeted in the media. He's 81 years old. Oh, he doesn't have the stamina for this, doesn't have the stamina for that. So what the Biden campaign has decided to do is like, oh, we're just going to send Biden out on a bunch of fundraisers. So he had a fundraiser in Reno and a fundraiser in Las Vegas in the state of Nevada, a state that the Biden campaign views as very close because of demographics that are favorable to swinging for Donald Trump, which I completely agree with, by the way. Nevada is a toss-up state. It's going to be one of the states that I'm pretty confident that Democrats are going to do a bit slightly worse than they did in 2020. It's going to be very, very close in 2024, and we're not going to know who won that state for days. So I'm in full agreement with the Biden campaign there. It's not the first trip Joe Biden's made to Las Vegas recently either. I think he made a visit, you know, only like a month ago. Like, and they've also been, you know, trying to hit up, you know, local Las Vegas, you know, newspapers, especially in a lot of these, you know, communities of color, a lot of diverse communities, especially in Las Vegas. If you haven't heard, no, there is a lot of, you know, Asian American, Pacific Islander communities, a lot of, you know, obviously Latinos. It's Las Vegas after all. A lot of, you know, even older retirees, a lot of, you know, Black Americans are in Nevada, which is slightly more conservative than average. So the Trump campaign could maybe try and get, you know, try to get better swings out of there than it can in a state, you know, in a state like Georgia with Black voters. So these are the things that the campaigns are taking into account, you know. And then Joe Biden went for basically a campaign stop. And I think there was a White House official thing going on in Phoenix, Arizona as well. Biden did some of his retail politicking that he is famous for, you know, going to these, you know, local businesses in Phoenix trying to court the Latino vote specifically. You know, Julie Chavez Rodriguez, the campaign manager for, you know, Joe Biden, you know, has, you know, like they have announced that they're going to, that Biden campaign is going to release a new ad and has released a new ad in English, in Spanglish, and in Spanish, you know, about, you know, only one choice. You know, and they run that ads throughout, you know, Latino news stations, you know, in heavily Latino communities, TV markets, you know, trying to reach, you know, more Spanish-speaking voters. One of the interesting things about the Latino vote is that Spanish-speaking voters are, or primarily Spanish-speaking voters, are far more likely to vote for Donald, for Joe Biden, than English-speaking voters. English-speaking Latinos are, if you believe some of the samples that Univision has, pretty even. Well, Biden by 7, and then Spanish-speaking voters are like Biden by 40 or something like that. So that is something that the Biden campaign, I think, is a very smart move. You know, try and turn out more Spanish-speaking voters, or primarily Spanish-speaking voters. Because if you don't, the Trump campaign will. I know the Biden campaign recently mocked, you know, Donald Trump and Dan Scavino. Oh, they're just reposting the same Yo Voy a Votar por Donald Trump ad that you had in 2020. The problem with mocking that is like, oh, a virginity, da-da-da. That ad worked. Like that ad very much worked because I hate to admit it, it's a fun jingle. Like, that is an earworm. It gets stuck in your head. Yo voy a votar por Donald Trump. Ah, look. Like, play that in Hialeah, and my God, you will have parades down the street for Donald Trump. Like, I'm not even joking. Coincidentally, also some of Donald Trump's strongest areas in Miami-Dade County were amongst particularly Cuban and heavily Cuban-American areas. And there's another, you know, nuance in regards to the Latino vote. Ethnically Mexican-American voters, you know, in, you know, Houston and especially San Antonio or Dallas, they're not going to be voting the same as Salvadoreños or Salvadorans in Northern Virginia. They're not going to be voting the same as Cuban-Americans in Miami-Dade County and Hialeah specifically, or even Cuban-Americans in Louisville. They're not going to be voting the same as ethnically Mexican-Americans in Los Angeles. Not going to be voting the same as, you know, Puerto Ricans, Puerto Ricanos in the Bronx or in other areas of New York City. Not going to be voting the same as South Americans or, you know, Colombians, Peruvians. Not going to be voting, they're not going to be voting the same as Hondurans or Nicaraguans, Panamanians, Dominicans. Like, there are these specific nuances that these campaigns have to understand. Like, no one Latino person or no one Latino community is the same as another. Like, the Latino community in Providence is miles different from the Latino community in Russellville, Alabama. And the Latino community that you find and that is somewhat prevalent in areas of South Georgia is going to be miles different from the Latino community you see in Osceola County, Florida. And, you know, ditto, you know, in San Jose, California. Like, there are these nuances you have to approach. Like, the Latino communities that you see in, you know, in the Atlanta metro, especially when you go along that belt from parts of Fulton into DeKalb and to essentially Gwinnett counties, they're not going to be the same Latino communities you're trying to reach out to in Las Vegas. And the ones you're going to try to reach out to, a lot of the heavily Puerto Rican populations in Reading and in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, they're not going to be the same ones that you're trying to reach out to in Detroit, Michigan. You know, Detroit has a pretty decently sized Latino population. And again, these nuances are, you know, something that you cannot take for granted, because something that hits wonderfully with a particular Latino community is not going to hit the same with another one. And ditto for Asian American, Pacific Islander voters as well. Like, what works for like a lot of Indian Americans isn't going to work for a lot of maybe Chinese Americans, Korean Americans, Japanese Americans, Filipinos, or whatnot. Now, the same thing with Pakistanis, Bangladeshis, and all these other, you know, wonderful, wondrous communities. So here's where the money spread comes in. You know, I talked about this, $155 million cash on hand for Biden, $43 million on hand for Donald Trump. Already, the Biden campaign is going to be spending in more places than the Trump campaign can. And it is also going to be spending more money in these specific states. You're not just going to be popping, like one day of ads towards, you know, towards Dallas-Fort Worth media market. I mean, expensive as the Dallas-Fort Worth media market is, mind you, one of the most expensive media markets in the nation to advertise in. That's not what the Biden camp is really going for. Like, obviously, you know, a state like Texas or a state like Florida, especially a state like Florida, they're secondary states. But campaign manager Julie Chavez Rodriguez, she announced that Biden campaign is going to spend in them. You know, apart from North Carolina, like, those are the only opportunities the Biden campaign has to expand the map. And while I do not advise spending in Florida, you know, if I was there, I'm like, look, don't really need to spend too much on Florida unless you want to make the Resist Lib donors in Florida happy. Go do a fundraiser there, as Biden has done recently, by the way. Go to fundraisers there, like, throw some money to keep them happy, maybe knock off Anna Pauline and Luna or something. Because remember, Pinellas County was one of Trump's weakest counties in that Florida primary, by the way. And yeah, I was thinking, you know, with these 2022 midterm results, Anna Paulina Luna barely overperforming, you know, Donald Trump's margins in 2020, as statewide Republicans were outperforming by 15 points. You know, thinking, oh, Anna Paulina Luna is a total fraud. Maybe that's less so now that I view these results. Maybe it was just more Pinellas County, you know, seeing some more recent leftward shifts, you know, at least in, you know, areas north of St. Petersburg. Who knows? Especially in Anna Paulina Luna's district. Maybe, you know, chuck a few mil there. Because you can't. You can do that with the over $110 million cash on hand discrepancy right now that you have against Donald Trump. Like, you get to blanket television in your ass, especially in the seven swing states that you've identified: Nevada, Arizona, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Georgia, and North Carolina. You get to blanket those states in ads. You get to dominate the airways. One of the reasons why Tom Suozzi in New York's 3rd Congressional District was able to win as much as he did, that should even slightly exceed Joe Biden's margins now, the final numbers from Nassau County are finally out, was because he was able to dominate the airways. He got well over 60% of the total TV time. And also, when you're donating specifically to a candidate, you know, and that candidate and their PACs, you know, the candidate campaigns, they get a much better deal on TV ads than an outside group coming in. Like, you know, Future 4 PAC is not getting the same deal as, say, a Biden Victory Fund, you know, and an outside PAC, like Club for Growth, is going to get a much worse deal on TV ad time than the Trump campaign. Or like the Ted Cruz campaign in 2016, for example. I mean, like look, and when you have this, you know, Chris Cillizza will go out there and say, oh, you know, I'm going to equivocate Biden, you know, equivocate isn't even a word, by the way. You know, he's going to make equivalencies. There's what I was going for. Joe Biden spending money in Texas is the same as Donald Trump saying he could win New York. Even though Joe Biden only lost Texas by 5.6 percentage points and Trump lost New York by well over 20 points. Yeah, but they're the same. The only reason they're the same is if the national environment was Trump by 10. Trust me, national environment's not going to be Trump by 10. I can tell you that right now. I will bet that if that happens, I will send a video out, you know, on the Pulse of the Nation Instagram account of me physically eating a piece of paper. I can promise you that, but it's not going to happen. I mean, even when you have hacks like Chris Cillizza, not sure how he's making a living writing about politics when he's got, you know, when he has takes that are more brain dead than the Virginia basketball offense. And again, another favorite of mine to dunk on for at least for me, obvious reasons. He's been having terrible takes for years, but it's not far-fetched when you consider that, you know, you can consult my entire, like, 45-minute spiel on why I think Texas is going to be very competitive in 2024 this year. You know, go to the spiel I did, like, almost a year ago at this point. But, yeah. But you get to spend in these areas because you have the massive monetary advantages. You don't just get to spend in the swing states. Donald Trump's spending is going to be a lot more concentrated in the swing states than it needs to be because his fundraising has been very poor. When you have the money spread, when the Trump campaign cannot even come close to going band for band with you, you get to spend money in Florida and Texas, especially Texas, which is going to be critical for Democrats' chances of holding the U.S. Senate. You get to spend in a place like Ohio because for every percentage point that Joe Biden chucks off of Donald Trump's margin in Ohio, the easier it becomes for Sherrod Brown to beat Bernie Moreno in that Ohio U.S. Senate race. You know, you could maybe chuck a couple million in Montana. I know it's not exactly the most advisable, but similar deal. Every percentage point you can chuck off of Donald Trump's margin, the more you can swing Bozeman left, the more you can make Billings not as conservative as it usually is, the more, you know, you can swing, you know, Western Montana left. It's not just going to help John Tester. You have a competitive House race in Western Montana. Montana's first congressional district. Ryan Zinke is going to be facing Monica Tranel again, I believe. And that's has all the makings of a very competitive race that the Democrats can win. So if you're continuing to swing Western Montana a lot more leftward than maybe it should be, then even if John Tester doesn't win, you're still reaping rewards because the U.S. House promises once again to be very competitive in 2024. If you're winning a seat in Montana, that's one more cushion against the New York Democrats screwing up an opportunity to flip the U.S. House of Representatives or California Democrats being lackadaisical. You know, you get to cover for another state party screw-ups, essentially. You know, missed opportunities by picking off opportunities in other areas. You know, Alabama's second congressional district is going to be an example of that thanks to redistricting. Louisiana's sixth congressional district is going to be another example of that thanks to redistricting. You get more cushion. You know, and especially considering that you get to now leverage the chaos that we had discussed on this podcast earlier in the U.S. House of Representatives, now led by Speaker Mike Johnson, the Republican from Shreveport, Louisiana. Now you get to leverage that in your ads, you know, and it's not just about getting the message out more. It's about spreading that message. You know, I talk about Florida and Texas, I'm also talking about spending, you know, in states that very much lean your way. States like New Hampshire, states like Minnesota, New Mexico, even a state like Colorado that, you know, lean your way now, but were once competitive. And if this is a red wave style environment, could very well be competitive again. A state like Maine. Like, you can spend there to shore yourself up because you can. And because largely you're going to go unchallenged in those states. Because Donald Trump cannot raise the money to do so. This is without the legal fees, by the way. The legal fees are only going to compound this problem. And what about other U.S. House races? You know, if the RNC doesn't have enough money to sort of help give to the RNCC, you know, if the Trump campaign, like, you can't share a lot of that money, the Biden campaign can. You can coordinate efforts, you know, using the efforts of the presidential campaigns to help U.S. House candidates, you know, in Long Island, New York, in Orange County, California, for example. You know, if you really want to do so, you could potentially focus on defending what you have in Michigan, flipping John James's district, in Michigan's 10th congressional district. You can flip back a lot of these Biden won seats that Republicans won in 2022, even Alaska. Like, if you could get to a point where it's like, okay, you have Mary Peltola, you know, you can chuck a couple million there, let Mary Peltola be the lead in Alaska for the Alaska Democratic Party, because they have kind of their own brand now, with Peltola being the main representative for the party's U.S. House representative from Alaska, succeeding the Republican Don Young. I mean, Alaska is going to be a state, I'm going to drop some gospel on y'all, Alaska is going to be a state that's decided in the single digits, probably the mid-single digits, the way that Anchorage is in Fairbanks have been swinging left. So you can chuck some money there at an effort to turn out Native American voters, Native Alaskan voters, you know, as part of a nationwide effort to do so. In a state like Arizona, the Navajo and the Hopi Nations and some of the other nations, the Ho-Ho-Nomo, whatever it is, you know, you go in there as well. You know, in a state like Nevada, in a state like North Carolina, potentially try to recover some of your losses with the Lumbee tribe in Robeson County. You know, you get to do these sort of things. You get to make sort of these campaign expenditures that would be very risky if Donald Trump could match you. But Donald Trump is nowhere close to matching if you're the Biden campaign. So you're like, okay, you get to spread him thin. You force him, if you force him to defend Texas, because that's what a lot of these early expenditures are for. Make Donald Trump defend North Carolina. Make him defend Texas. Texas is going to be the big one because, like, you have all this money coming into Texas, not just Democratic money. Colin Allred is not going to be starting for money, by the way. He's one of the biggest, best fundraisers the Democratic Party has in 2024. And in Texas, it's going to go a very long way with those media markets in Houston and San Antonio and Austin and Dallas and everywhere, essentially. Even South Texas isn't that cheap. But you get to do these sort of things. You know, you get to spend in states you usually wouldn't spend, not just in trying to expand the map, but make sure that if your candidate loses, it's not a complete demolition of the party. When you have the $112 million or so cash on hand discrepancy in your favor, you know, you get to make expenditures that the Trump campaign can't match right now. And when you get closer in these elections, then these expenditures often have diminishing returns. Like, if you're not able to spend until very late, you're in a close race, you're screwed. Like, in a toss-up race, if you are defined early, or if there is like a period of a few weeks where you are defined and you're not hitting back in TV ads, as we saw the Wisconsin Senate race with Mandela Barnes in Wisconsin, Ron Johnson was able to beat him off of that. Like, if you're not able to respond effectively, if you don't have the necessary TV time to do so, you're screwed. So this is something that we have to watch as we go on. And the impending trials that are going to be coming up soon for Donald Trump in like a few months, like, there is a possibility that we could be in the, you know, middle, like the top and the bottom of the ninth innings in regards to this general election campaign. And instead of campaigning like he should be, Donald Trump is out, you know, at these courthouses, you know, standing trial. That is a very distinct possibility. October surprises are called October surprises for a reason, y'all. And something else about these rallies is not just, oh, he can't do as many rallies because he has these court appearances. Fact of the matter is, he might be too broke to do rallies. Because recently, he just had to cancel a rally in Arizona to prioritize spending more time at a Buckeye Values Pack rally in Dayton, Ohio for Bernie Moreno. Now, a part of me also thinks canceling a rally in Arizona, which is a critical swing state by any stretch of the imagination, talk to any mainstream analyst, they'll tell you Arizona's a critical swing state. Maybe the Trump campaign's seeing poll numbers that a lot of people aren't. And they're seeing the same thing I'm seeing. Saw the primary results where Donald Trump did terribly in the East Valley, especially on Scottsdale. And he's saying, well, Democrats might rob the victory in Arizona. And I could completely understand that if I'm the Trump campaign. Because I'm going to say this right now, Arizona is a state that Joe Biden needs to have in order to win. It's not a state Trump needs to have. It's just swinging too far to the left. And the demographics are too favorable for Democrats in regards to swings and trends left. Republicans can put up a fight, but we saw this in 2022 with like a Trump by four, Trump by five elector. Republicans blew nearly every statewide competitive race that they had. And considering the direction of the state party, the civil war that state party just went through, considering that their Senate nominee is Kari Lake, that's not going to change. Like, that is not going to change whatsoever. So So again, and you also have internal civil wars in a state like Michigan. Republicans think they should win Michigan. CNN thinks that Michigan leans towards the Republicans for gods or whatever reason. No. People forget Michigan voted for Biden by 156,000 votes. People forget Biden has aligned himself so much with the labor unions. Labor unions are pretty big in Michigan. So, not sure where the illusion is coming from, CNN, but you do you. And again, Michigan is going to be a state where that is going to be focused on by the Biden campaign in tremendous amounts. And Donald Trump's not going to be able to spend nearly as much money there, because not only is a lot of it going towards legal fees, right now he's a worse fundraiser than Joe Biden. And for a guy that, you know, the Republican Party views as senile, as old, the majority of the American public views as incompetent to serve another 4 years in office, the majority of the American public doesn't think he'll be able to serve another 4 years in office, how embarrassing must it be for Donald Trump to get lapped in fundraising by that guy? Oh, and speaking of fundraisers, there's going to be one fundraiser that's coming up in New York City. It's at Radio City Music Hall, and it's going to be the biggest fundraiser in Democratic Party history, potentially in U.S. history. Even bigger in raw dollar value amounts than what Standard Oil gave to William McKinley's campaign in 1896. That was a $250,000, Standard Oil gave McKinley's campaign. Right now, in real dollars, that would be about $9.2 million in 2024. This fundraiser is going to feature three Democratic presidents: Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and Joe Biden. It's going to have Stephen Colbert there, I think, interviewing the three presidents, having an event with the three presidents. Photo ops are going for as little as $100,000. So yeah, top dollar, y'all. Top dollar. I know I ain't talking about the guy who is now working in TNA for whatever reason. You know, tickets are going on sale for as low as $250. Still pretty penny for people like me and people like a lot of us who are watching. But when you compare to some of those other dollar amounts, whew. But that's supposed to bring in over $10 million. Or, you know, nearly one-fourth of the entirety of the cash on hand that Donald Trump's campaign apparatus has. And that's just one fundraiser. One. Like, do y'all see the vision yet? Like, y'all seeing the vision? This is an election that, oh, you have an unpopular incumbent. The Challengers Party should be winning easily. But the Challengers Party, in my opinion, you can ignore the polling for a second, which the polling is showing the Republican Party should be doing well. Donald Trump should be beating Joe Biden. Look at all these critical swing states. Trump is leading Biden in all these polls. But in everything else, the Republican Party is doing everything to blow this election. Doing everything to blow this election. Like, you shouldn't take the polls as gospel right now. Polls usually only become reliable again after the conventions. We've got a few months. And granted, if these polls don't change, it's all right for Democrats to worry. I will worry. But again, if the special elections, if the elections where people actually vote get taken into account, and you're still seeing the same things I'm seeing right now, where the environment is going to be similar to 2020, if not a bit to the left of that. Right now, the combined special election averages after the 2022 midterms, about a point to the left. 2023, Democrats did a lot better than 2024. But when you take into account all these averages, the averages point to about a D by 5, D by 6 environment, which would be a 319 electoral vote environment for Joe Biden at minimum, flipping North Carolina, holding on to all of your other states. That's an environment where Democrats can win a federal trifecta somehow. Although, that would involve flipping Texas, let's be completely honest. You have to assume one of Ohio or Montana are going to flip to Republicans. Even if the nominees are Tim Shahey, i.e. Montana's version of Adam Laxalt, or Bernie used car salesman Moreno. But when you take into account these special elections, these don't get nationalized. But there is one that has been. And that is, this is where the last topic I go before I take out my ratings outlook for the presidency. I'm going to talk about House District 10 again. The special election is coming up this Tuesday. And last I spoke of it, I said it was going to be a very competitive race. Both, you know, and Maryland's polling show that was close, Teddy Powell had himself favored. But now, this race has gotten a lot of national attention because of the IVF stuff, because of the abortion issue. And now, you know, you have CNN, you have the Situation Room. Wolf Blitzer's talking about Huntsville, Madison County, Triana, you know, Redstone Arsenal. You have all this space camp stuff going on now where more anti-trans policies are being put onto state bills because of pressure from conservatives. And these issues are now becoming nationalized. You have more national outlets covering this specific race in these specific suburbs. Went from Trump by 13 to Trump by less than a point. From 2016 to 2020, it is a district that I said repeatedly is most likely going to vote for Joe Biden by a healthy margin. And Marilyn Lance herself is saying that she had a lot more, you know, excitability amongst her campaign now than she had in 2022. And in 2022, she outperformed. She outran the top of the ticket by a few points. Like, she lost by, like, what? I believe, like, less than 7 points or so when, you know, Katie Britt was winning this area by 11 or so. So that special election is going to be seen as a national test. If Democrats are able to win this special election, that will give them more of a momentum boost. And again, that will slightly add to the fundraising haul and the fundraising advantage that Democrats have. So my ratings outlook, this is what we're going to end it off on. I'm going to be doing ratings outlooks, you know, every 2 weeks to a month or so. But I'll tell y'all the episode before I release a ratings outlook when I do it. I'll also be doing ratings outlooks for the U.S. Senate and for the U.S. House. Those will be coming up soon. So we're going to go from West Coast to East Coast, y'all. So be ready. So Alaska I have is likely Republican because I've said earlier, I mean, Alaska only voted for Trump by less than 11 points in 2020. It's swinging left. Mary Peltola represents it in the U.S. House. And with Anchorage and with Fairbanks and Juneau swinging left, I see it as a mid-single digits Trump win. Trump will win the state, but it's going to be closer than a lot of people expect. Washington, Oregon, California, safe Democratic. And Hawaii also safe Democratic. I don't really need to explain why. Arizona, lean Democratic. Because I know, you know, mainstream media will probably have it as a toss-up, but look, y'all, I have a feeling Joe Biden's going to clean Donald Trump's clock out in Arizona. It is a state that has, you know, a high Latino population, but Arizona Latinos didn't swing as much to the right as, you know, other Latinos across the country did. Now, granted, there probably have some slight rightward swings, but when you have Scottsdale, when you have all these wider, more college-educated northern Phoenix suburbs swinging like 5 to 10 points to the left, that's a death sentence for Arizona Republicans who have already made a habit out of losing competitive races. They've made this a habit since 2018, for crying out loud. So yeah, leans Democratic. Nevada's a toss-up. Probably going to be decided within a point because that's just how Nevada rolls. New Mexico is solidly Democratic. Like, look, Joe Biden's probably going to win it by over double digits, over 10 points. And if it's going by over 10 points, it's going to be safe Democratic. Same thing with Colorado. No way Donald Trump swings Colorado rightwards. Joe Biden won it by 13 points. He's probably going to win it by close to 20 this time around. The Colorado Republican Party is a giant mess. I've discussed this in, you know, past episodes. I'm not going to go over here. But yeah, Utah, safe Republican. And for obvious reasons, although could be interesting to see some of the under the hood shifts left in Salt Lake City and potentially even in Logan, Cache County, watch out. But yeah, Idaho, you know, Montana, Wyoming, safe Republican. Montana, though, again, under the hood shifts. You have a U.S. Senate race to watch. That'll be the main event in that state. North Dakota, South Dakota, safe Republican. Don't need to explain why. Nebraska, statewide, safe Republican. Nebraska's third district, safe Republican. Nebraska's first district, this is around Lincoln and some of the surrounding rural areas and exurbs of Omaha, likely Republican, because again, that's something that Trump will win, but it'll be in the single digits, closer than people expect. Nebraska second at the federal level, that's Omaha. That's safe Democratic. I'm going to go out on a limb. Nebraska's second district is safe Democratic at the presidential level. It might be too much for Don Bacon to overcome. At the House level, though, I think it's a toss-up because Don Bacon's still a really strong incumbent. Kansas is likely Republican. Did you see the primary results out in Kansas where Donald Trump nearly lost a quarter of Kansas Republicans after the primary cycle was over? I mean, Kansas is going to be a state that votes for Trump, of course, but only by single digits. Because I think the national environment is going to be very similar to where it was in 2020. Oklahoma, safe Republican. Texas leans Republican. Trump should win the state, but it's going to be very competitive. And if the Republicans blow it enough, like, it would be very hilarious. There is a slight possibility Biden wins the state. Very slight, though. Now, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, South Carolina, safe Republican. Arkansas, Tennessee, you know, up to Missouri, Kentucky, Indiana, you know, all safe Republican as well. Georgia's a toss-up. North Carolina's a toss-up. Florida is likely Republican, only because I don't think Trump's going to hit a double-digit margin of victory there. A state like Minnesota, yes, there is a lot of leftist discontent in Minnesota. Minnesota's a pretty progressive state, but still safe Joe Biden, still safe Democratic. Illinois, safe Democratic. Wisconsin's a toss-up. Michigan, I think, is a toss-up. Pennsylvania, I think it is a toss-up. West Virginia, obviously safe Republican. You know, Ohio, I think, is likely Republican. Iowa is safe Republican. I think Donald Trump wins Ohio by like 11 points or so. I think that state's just going to keep shifting right because it's too dominated by the rurals, which are shifting right. You know, low college education rates. I mean, it might not be a double-digit margin of victory, but it's close enough. I'll put it in safe Republican. I mean, watch out for like Des Moines and Iowa City, particularly that southwestern congressional district in Iowa, the Iowa 3rd congressional district held by Zach Nunn. He could be a 2022, like one-term, like wave baby or something like that. But going up, obviously, D.C., Maryland, some of the safest Democratic states you'll see. Don't believe the hubbub about, you know, oh, Larry Hogan's leading in the polls. Nah, this is just Phil Bredesen, but in Republican form. Safe. That Senate race is also safe Democratic. Don't worry about that. In a state like Delaware, safe Democratic. New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Vermont, safe Democratic. New Hampshire is safe Democratic to me as well. Joe Biden's winning that by over double digits. I'm extremely convinced of that. Maine at large, I think, is safe Democratic for similar reasons. Maine's first, obviously, safe Democratic. Maine's second, I believe, is, I want to say lean because I don't think the margin will be that big, but it'll be likely Republican because Donald Trump should not be losing that. It's a less of a chance to lose Maine's second congressional district than he has at losing Texas, in my opinion. So those are my presidential ratings. I have Biden as about a 65 to 35 favorite over Donald Trump in this presidential election. But, you know, this is March. As John Rothstein says, this is March. Anything can happen from March up until the general election. Things can change in a hurry. I know that everybody knows these two presidential candidates already, but this is still politics and anything can happen. And that's why we try to bring you the Pulse of the Nation every week. Thank you for listening to us through the spiel about the presidential election. We'll bring you some, you know, more regular content next week as we enter the end of March and into April. Thank you for listening. This has been the Pulse of the Nation.
Any opinions expressed in this program are those of the host and do not represent the thoughts or opinions of 90.7 WVUA or the University of Alabama.
WVUA-FM, Tuscaloosa.